behalf of Concordia University, I'm very pleased indeed to introduce our guest tonight, Irish novelist Patrick McCabe. As the director of the Center for Canadian Irish Studies, I'm particularly gratified that our cooperation with the English Department's Writers Read series at Concordia has allowed us for the third consecutive year to bring one of contemporary Ireland's outstanding writers to the Concordia and indeed to the wider communities. And I too would like to reiterate the words of Michael and thank the Faculty of Arts and Science and David Graham for the generous support of this series. When Patrick McCabe's novels began to appear in Ireland in the 1980s and 90s, the response was a somewhat mystified acknowledgement that these works were attempting something entirely new in Irish writing, not simply in terms of the unusual and quite extraordinary subjects he tackled, but in the wonderfully freewheeling, exuberant style with which they caught nuances of character and relentlessly and energetically drove narrative and plot. In these novels, we found language that had all the stops taken out, as it were, not the usual, somewhat sedately moving prose that had marked recent Irish writing, but instead words hurtling forward at a relentless canter, driven by energy, imagination, and creative verve, not really seen in Irish fiction since passages of James Joyce's Ulysses. In novels such as The Butcher Boy, Breakfast on Pluto, and Call Me the Breeze, Patrick McCabe revealed the potential of a highly idiosyncratic and subjective syntax, which incorporated a wide range of idiomatic gymnastics and cultural references to create a unique world. This was the world of small-town Ireland, still enervated and languishing without direction 50 years after Irish independence, a place where sensitive and yearning young people found themselves encased by powerful social forces so ubiquitous as to be almost invisible. Patrick McCabe has caught the almost palpable sense of this reality in which the marginalized individual searches for understanding and for love. In doing so, his novels now stand as witness to pre-Celtic Tiger Ireland, which would begin to wash away, erase, and forever transform this reality. Yet for us, his readers, the great value of Patrick McCabe's writing is that his hugely entertaining language and spectacular literary style convincingly portray characters that suffer and strive for redemption in ways that speak powerfully to our postmodern condition. Patrick McCabe is a writer whose work captures recognizable elements of all our lives. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming him to Concordia and to Montreal.
Introduction, I can only disappoint you. Thank you very much indeed, Michael. That was a lovely, very, very succinct and very accurate. I mean, I don't mean in terms of the praise, but in terms of what one might be trying to do, it is very gratifying to hear it so succinctly put. Thank you very much for that. The book I would like to read from tonight is called Winterwood, which isn't actually published yet. It's coming out on the 6th of November, and I haven't read from it before. Just by way of introduction, I would like to say that central characters are, I mean, in a way, it's a kind of an extension of the doppelganger Gothic trope of a person being the two sides of the same coin. And the two protagonists in this novel are called Ned Strange and Redmond Hatch. And any Irish scholars or Gaelic scholars among you will know that the word atch is the Gaelic word for strange. By way of explanation, a ceilidh is a hoedown of sorts. A stogie is a roll-up cigarette. The clear is potsheen or moonshine. And sleeve na gíha means mountain of the wind. Chapter 1. My journey westward, my mountain home. It was the autumn of 1981 that I'd been asked by my paper, the Leinster News, to do an article on folklore and changing ways in Ireland. A chance I jumped at, availing myself of the opportunity to return home to Slieve na Gaeilge, which I hadn't been to visit in years. And was more than glad that I did, as it happened, for quite unexpectedly it turned out to be festival week, with the ceilidh starting up as I drove into town. On a crude platform in the square, a slap-bass combo was banging away a good old with a whiskery old-timer sawing at a spindle, stomping out hornpipes to beat the band. He must have been close on 70 years of age, with a curly copper thatch and this great unruly rusty beard touched throughout with streaks of silver. He slapped his thighs and whooped and catcalled, encouraging anyone who knew it to join in the traditional come all you, who by the looks of things weren't exactly a multitude. In fact, nobody at all seemed to know the words. Presumably because prosperity had begun to take hold of the valley, with such ballads being perceived now as something out of date. There was no shortage, however, of spirited shouts of approval. Good man, Ned, you never lost it. He's a good one, our pappy, make no mistake. As the band cheered and corded along merrily, the lyrics sailing out over the tall pine trees. Well, don't we look sweet as here we both lie, my partner forever, just him and I. Like lovers betrothed in the cold stony clay, from peep of the sun until the end of the day. In keeping with the good old days theme, everyone had dressed up in breeches and brogues, with not a modern conveyance in sight. Nothing but a motley assortment of sharabanks and cars. There were livestock shows and cattle auctions, horse pulling contests and a poultry competition. A woman in a bonnet offered to sell me the choicest free range eggs. I thanked her profusely but politely declined, regretting it somewhat, I have to say, when she mentioned my father. She told me she had known him well. Ah, yes, she said. Old Daddy Hatch. Sure, we all knew each other back in those days. He goes off drinking with Ned Strange and back up to the shack he lives in the woods. It was the first time Ned had ever mentioned Olson in my company. John Olson was a local man who'd made his fortune in the US. He thought he owned the place, you might know. He used to drive around in this fancy big limousine. You should have seen that conceited face. I've decided to honor you with my presence, so you can count yourself lucky. You can count yourself lucky, mongrel scum. That's what Olson was thinking to himself. That's what that luck were saying, Redmond. Look at me. So what do you think? Am I king of the mountain or not? Are you lucky or not to have me home? Oh, Slieve na Gaeilge, I think you are. I think that you are very fortunate indeed. And after all, I should know, I am Mr. John. I'm Mr. John fucking Olson. He scrunched the stogie beneath the heel of his boot. Cunt, he said. Cunt and whore. That is a thief cut his throat. As true as I'm standing here in my own fucking kitchen. Do you hear me, Redmond? Are you listening to me, boy? I kept hoping against hope that his mood would change, as it so often did, without any warning. That he'd, out of nowhere, erupt into laughter, insisting that it had all been a joke. He didn't, however. He just stood there in silence, picking at the damp book he'd found as it disintegrated in his hands. Staring with a fierce and deeply troubling tenacity of purpose at the blurred italicized signature. To Anna Marie, from John Olson with Love. Slieve na Gaeilge, 1963. I began to dread hearing John Olson's name. But whether I did or whether I didn't seem to amount to a whole lot of consequence. I'm not sorry for what I'd done to him, me Paul. That was why I went to America, Redmond. They think I didn't go. They think I never went near the States. That's what they say. That's what they'll tell you down in the pub. That's what he told you that first night, I know. I heard him.
Old Ned would never be able to do the like of that. He'd never stray beyond these hills. These hills are his home, the only home he knows. And that's where they're wrong. For Ned did stray. He did go to America. He went there and a lot of other places too. But they'll never know, the ignorant fools. I tried to come up with an excuse to get out. But as if it was as if he was defying me to do exactly that. He persisted with his monologue. I had never heard anything quite so venomous, even from his mouth. I shifted uneasily in the chair. He looked at me accusingly. You want to say something? To me? What is it you want to say, Ren? I said, you said you did something to John Olson. What was it you did?
I hurt him bad. I cut him with a blade. No, I didn't. I beat him. I beat him to within an inch of his life. That's what I did to Olson, the snake weapon.
His eyes filled up with loathing. I caught a glimpse of my ashen face in the window. Why did you have to do that? I asked him. It sounded stupid, I could see that. I ought to have said nothing. He teased his beard and then all of a sudden snapped, why? Did I hear you say why, Redmond? Because he deserved it, you stupid cunt. He deserved it on account of him and my Anne Marie. And it was as if all the shadows in the room had suddenly decided to converge on my chair. As though collectively to pose that very same conundrum. Why are you asking stupid questions, Ren? Foolishly, I had spilt some of the clear down my jacket. You could see that he had noticed but had decided to let it pass. He upended his mug and brutally continued. Some people says that if a woman does you wrong, that if she happens to stray from the conjugal bower, then what you got to do, what your responsibility is to search in your heart and see if you can find her some, extend her some small measure of forgiveness. Me? I don't happen to believe that, you see. Redmond, I searched in my heart all right, but I couldn't find anything that was of any use to me in there. Nothing. I tried Jesus, too. Him and all his other do-good cronies. But they were no use either. No good, my boy, not worth a flying fuck. Do you find that disappointing, Redmond? Well, if you do, I apologize for that. Anyway, it had upset me so bad I had to ask her again. Anna Marie, my darling, I said to her, why did you do it? Why did you let Olson put it in you as tallywhacker? She wouldn't tell me, Redmond. She just kept on saying she hadn't permitted it. Until I swear I couldn't take it anymore, and says to her, Anna Marie, Merle, you know now it's going to happen. No, she says, what is it? Anna Marie, I says, it's the cellar. Oh no, she said, not the cellar. Yes, I'm afraid it is, I said. But you know the saddest thing, Redmond? She never repented. Not once. Every time I looked in her eyes, I could see she was still thinking of it. That old snake Olson, he was still on her mind. Damn near broke my heart, said the thing. So what did you do? I asked. My saliva formed a thick and distasteful ball inside my mouth. He lowered his eyes and gazed at the floor. Then he raised them again and flashed his incisors. And the look he gave me chilled my blood. Like to know. Who knows? Maybe I'll tell you. Maybe I'll tell you one day just how it ended between us. Between me and the lovely Anna Marie Gordon. It was the last thing I wanted to hear. Anything connected with good, loving, gone bad. For in those days, my marriage to Catherine was close to perfect. a flawless union. The sort of partnership people dream about. We'd met at a dance in July 1980 in a town in County Cork where I'd been covering some local story. I can't even remember what it was now. She was one of the Courtneys, a well-known merchant family in the area. Her beauty was unique. It's as simple as that. It was unusual to find someone like her working in a bar. I remember suggesting to her that that was unusual. She laughed and said she'd been studying at UCC, history and philosophy, but had failed her finals and not bothered repeating. These things happen, I said, somewhat vaguely, discreetly trying to avoid her lovely green blue eyes. We ended up dating, and within 3 or 4 weeks, well, if you're talking about enchantment of the heart, then all I can say is I came to know quite a bit about that particular subject. Not to put too fine a point on it, I fell head over heels in love with Catherine Courtney, telling her things I'd never told anyone, which was regrettable. I made it my business to travel down from Dublin whenever I could. I used to love sitting in the pub with her while she had her lunch. She told me she adored the musician John Martin. At the time, I'd never even heard of him. A situation which I went about rectifying straight away, and the next time we met, I presented her with an album of his called Grace and Danger. There was a track on it she grew to love. It was called Sweet Little Mystery, and any time I heard it, it thrilled me. It was as if John Martin had somehow known. If that doesn't sound too foolish. A lot of what she said I never even heard. Too busy staring at her lips or her hair. Then one day I found myself saying, Catherine Courtney, will you marry me? I hadn't given her any warning at all. Yes, she said. Yes, Redmond, I will, leaning forward and taking my hand. I couldn't believe my luck. I just sat there staring in silence, like a simpleton. Then she laughed and kissed me on the cheek. She was wearing a silver necklace which she fingered a little nervously and abstractedly, playing with the dangling charm, a shining initial, the letter C. Look at you, she said, and laughed again, a tincture of pink appearing on her cheek. We were married exactly 6 months after that, in 1981. I was 40 and she was 22, but the age difference didn't matter one whit. That was what she had said, and that was what I knew. It was the greatest day of my life, no question. We rented a basement flat in Dublin in the South City suburb of Leafy Rath Mines in an old rambling run-down Georgian house in Cargill Road. It wasn't much, but it was all we could afford. It didn't matter, we told ourselves. It wouldn't be always like this. Sooner or later, our ship would come in. And who knows, maybe we'll be able to afford a mansion, she used to say, tossing her scarf back with a kind of impish devil-may-care laugh. On weekends, we used to visit houses that were for sale, just for amusement and something to do. There was one she took a special shine to. It was situated in the suburb of Rathfarnham on Ballyroan Road. It had a lovely little apple orchard out the back. I could tell by her expression that she really loved that house. Maybe one day, I remember saying, squeezing her arm as we strolled towards the bus stop. You'd hear her humming and it would do your heart good. She was humming it on the bus that day, going home. It's just that sweet little mystery that's here in your heart. It's just that sweet little mystery that makes you. I continued working for the Leinster News, serialising my articles and going down to visit Ned Strange in Sligo Gaeilge. Rathmines then was a lovely place to live, and Catherine got work at the various bars, frequented in the main by students. I used to meet her in the Sunset Grill after work, a little place not far from the library. Our treats at that time were Knickerbocker glories. It was stupid, I know. Love makes you like that. We continued living in Cogber Road. Then our firstborn, a girl, arrived 2 years later in March 1983. We decided to call her Imogen after Catherine's grandmother. She was a wonder. To look at, to listen to, everything.
Every day I woke up, she filled my heart with pride. Catherine Courtney had been given to me as a gift, and now there was Imogen. She had her mother's looks, the green blue eyes, and the very same laugh. I used to take her in the evenings in a wheeler buggy through the streets of Rathmines, before we'd meet her mother in the Sunset Grill, after her shift had ended in the pub. On my way into work, I would find myself lapsing into a daydream, unable to understand what it was I had done to deserve such bounteous, unmitigated good fortune. But then nothing, of course. Nothing is ever as simple as that. You should never really expect it to be. We had been in Rathmines for almost 4 years and fully intended to carry on doing just that, when in March 1985, the Leinster News unexpectedly went into liquidation, and after months of looking around the city with little or no success, I was on the verge of becoming really worried when, quite out of the blue, I was offered a position with a small newspaper in London, the North London Chronicle, which at first, I won't pretend otherwise, I was quite hesitant about. It seemed such a big step with a young child and everything. And details of the salary were vague, to say the least. After some time talking it over, Catherine suggested that I ought to take it. She had been toying with the idea of going back to college, she said, for some time, and London would provide lots of opportunities. Perhaps it was time for us to broaden our horizon. To make a long story short, I called them and accepted. We moved to London some weeks later, and initially things, I have to say, they looked really positive. But then, unfortunately, fate intervened and we encountered, I suppose, what you might call another small piece of misfortune. The North London Chronicle was bought out by a rival, and the core staff, including me, were let go without a settlement. Initially, there was a lot of bellicose talk in the pub, with the union official pledging retribution and vengeance. But in the end, as I had anticipated, his passionate belligerence all came to nothing. But even then, Catherine Courtney and I remained undaunted, picking up pieces of work here and there. I spent a while on a free sheet in Cricklewood, and Catherine did stretches in an off-license called Victoria Wine in various cafes and bars. Then we discovered that if one of us didn't work, we'd actually be better off, qualifying both for income support and housing benefit. We debated it for a while, but then I decided that I could work from home, submitting articles on a freelance basis. It worked like a dream. Dropping Emmy to the nursery every day before coming home to sit down at my typewriter. With the result being that against all the odds, we now found ourselves now attaining an altogether new level of happiness. Considering how contented we had been to begin with, it really was quite remarkable. And it made me feel so proud. All I kept thinking was the miraculous things that in adversity can happen to an ordinary man and woman, just so long as they're fortunate enough to be in love. There is no happiness or joy that can come close to the feelings you experience in such a blessed situation. I picked up Imogen every day at the same time, chattering to her the whole way home. Such a chatterbox she was becoming. We always had great fun walking through Queen's Park with her sucking her lollipop and me singing the theme tune from My Little Pony, shouting Kimono and Pinkie Pie, the names of all the characters she loved. Sometimes we'd just stop there and sit in the park telling stories, but that often wasn't such a good idea. For no sooner would you have finished than she'd want you to start all over again. Of course it would irritate you sometimes, if you had been having articles rejected or whatever. But nonetheless, you always did. Once we were in the little cafe and she started sobbing. "What's wrong?" She pointed to the ground where a great stag beetle was lying on its back as a column of ants made off with its innards. "Don't let the mini beasts get me, Daddy," she wept. "I won't," I assured her and took her in my arm. She was still sobbing a little bit. "Our teacher says the mini beasts are our friends," she said. "But if they were, they wouldn't do that." "Mummy," she would squeal when Catherine was with us. "Daddy tells stories.
about the snowman? She couldn't get enough of that Raymond Briggs story. She watched the video over and over. She'd just sit there, wrapped with her tense shoulders up as off he went, the little snowman waltzing, right out up across the rooftops of the world. The new Kilburn flat we got off the Housing Association, it really looked fantastic now. The things that woman Catherine could do with interior. She had completely and utterly transformed the place. And Imogen, by all accounts now, was the playroom star. They were always telling me what a character she was. They really were such a beautiful time. Such beautiful time. All the more reason I was completely unprepared for it when I came home one day after buying a present, a Polly Pocket for Imogen's birthday, and discovered Catherine in her bedroom with a man. Devil's bargain. Nobody bothers with religion anymore. Huddled shapes raggedly and sparsely embroider the black depths of the cloisters, idling outside by the rain-swept granite gables, shambling about like they're already dead. Stray mongrels loiter aimlessly by the rusty churchyard gates, drooping moss clings to ancient defeated Marian shrines. Clergymen appear weighed down by guilt, shuffling obsequiously through streets full of shame. A lot of them have been convicted of the same crime as Ned Strange. The priest I dealt with was kind, considerate, but he looked drained and impossibly tired. Somewhat abstractedly, he informed me that persistence was all I required. Persistence and time. Smiling unconvincingly. I felt sorry for him, but still drifted out in the middle of his homily. It was a windswept day on Harold's Cross Road. The rain was blowing in swathes towards the city as I stood there clinging to the churchyard railings, my entire body shuddering violently, tears mingling with raindrops as they coursed down my face.
Be mindful that having exercised your will contrary to that of God and chosen iniquity, you alone will be responsible for the consequences, I heard, and became afraid. But in the end, I didn't care. I knew I no longer had any choice. I simply had nowhere else to go. Yes, I cried, and yes again. A woman was observing me. I glared at her, don't come near me. Don't dare come near me, I said in my eyes. I was lathered in sweat. Thick saliva had gathered on my lips. I felt like turning and spitting at the church. Extremes of heat and cold went surging through me. Warm blood cascading from my nostrils. Redmond, I heard, softly whispered in the wind. You know you can trust me. I look after you. Till the very last pea is out of the pot, till the angels quit the hallowed halls of heaven.
For the first time in years, I felt I belonged. Thank you, I answered happily, as my voice was carried off on the breeze, and I applied the sodden crimson hanky to my face. Contrary to what might have been expected in the circumstances, finding myself in a state of what can only be described as near delirium. When I looked again, the woman was gone, the bus plashing onwards towards the golden, lit-up city. The story of Little Red. Little Red lived in the mountain valley. He lived in the valley with his dad and his man. But then one day, it was decided he wasn't to live with them anymore. He was sitting by the fire warming his hands in their cabin when all of a sudden a large shadow appeared and fell across the floor. The little boy was surprised because he hadn't been quite expecting that. The shadow turned out to be that of a priest.
In those far-off days, it was the custom of clergymen to wear a hat. A great big broad-brimmed special priest's hat. This clergyman was wearing one and carrying a great big leather missal. Its zip was golden. He paused for a moment before saying, "Little Red." Everyone called the boy that. Although he was sitting by the fire where it was warm, he was still wearing his new overcoat. The one with the big buttons and the brown velvet collar. The one which his mother had bought him in Burton's of the city. The priest felt the collar and inquired of him softly, "Did your mother buy it for you in Burton's of the city?" Little Red confirmed that yes, indeed, she did. She had done that. The priest looked away for a moment and then said, "Ah." Before pushing back his big priest's hand, Little Red formed the impression that the clergyman was very tired. He watched him rubbing his face with his soft, unweathered hands, probably very tired, regularly delivering news of the sort he was about to hear, to the effect that the boy's mother, Mrs. Hatch, wouldn't be dealing with Miss Burton's of the city any longer, or Burton's of anywhere else, for she'd just have been found dead whilst praying in the chapel. "Praying at the altar rails," he said. "We found her prostrate at the feet of Jesus. She's happy where she is now, my son." That was the story of Mal Hatch's death. Or as Ned Strange used to say, your version of it, Redman. It was still in my mind when we set off for the valley the following day to start filming. We arrived at the Sleeve McGee Hotel about 6. And I'd gone to bed early, for it had been a long drive, as I had to rise at 6. The first thing I noticed when I awoke around 1 was the wide open window, which I was absolutely certain that closed before retiring. I couldn't for the life of me figure out how that had happened. I went to get a drink, but the taps were bone dry. The following night wasn't any better. I woke at 3, ice cold and shaking all over. But at least this time there was water in the taps. I had made it my business to make sure of that. "What sort of hell sort of a hotel is this?" I'd snapped at the manager. There was a force 10 gale blowing outside. You could see the mountains rearing like horses before the face of the moon, flashing their incisors and tossing their fierce black proud heads, ropes of saliva hanging from their pink lips. I did my best to keep my imagination in check. That was a problem I'd had as a boy. I sat on the edge of the bed, steadying the trembling glass in my hand, trying hard not to think about Uncle Florian, about Little Red, about being back in the valley, but it had all started again. I jerked when I thought I had heard Ned's voice. Then I saw his face in the window, winking at me in that awful way he did, raking his fingers through his mass of red hair. When I looked again, the face was gone. Everyone loved him, Uncle Florian. There wasn't a tune he couldn't play. Slip jigs, hornpipes, high reels, polkas. You name it, Florian could play it. He had played on hundreds of occasions, not just in Ireland, but all over the world. In Newfoundland, Cape Breton and Argentina too. There was nowhere him and his fiddle hadn't been. There was also talk of him having lived in America, but that couldn't be confirmed. And Florian wouldn't help. He'd just sit there grinning and baring his teeth and tapping his foot and reaching for his tail. There were some people in the valley who couldn't abide him, who judiciously went out of their way to avoid him. "Malice," you'd hear them whisper. "There's a very bad drop in that wicked bastard. I'd just be afraid it'd travel down the line. That's all I'd be afraid of, especially now the little boy's mother was gone." Well, anyhow, the day finally came when the car arrived to take away Little Red, driving him off to the home of Holy Jesus. The home was run by the Nazareth nuns.
There's damn all option open to me now, now that herself has been taken up to heaven, but to send the little fella to the nuns in the orphanage.
His father offered by way of explanation.
For me and Florian, sure, we don't understand things the way women does. We're just not fit to look after him anymore. Isn't that the truth?
His brother Florian would nod gravely.
As long as we make sure to visit him regularly, he said, there's damn it to hell it might turn out so bad. I'll see that it won't, for I'm the boy that won't forget that little fella. He's a topper, that's what he is. Why, I'll bring him chocolate every week. I'll bring him a dang sweet bar of chocolate.
You're a good one, the boy's father replied and produced the clear to reward his brother.
We all stick together here on the mountain, he said, and we won't let him down, that young fella of mine. Now you're talking, Florian cried. We'll go down to the orphanage every week, and maybe when things has kind of improved, he'd be fit to come home and live here with us forever. Back to home to the mountain when things are settled.
Good health, cried Florian, emptying his mug. As a matter of fact, I'll visit the boy this very coming Sunday. So the following Sunday, what did the occupants of a certain grey utilitarian building hear disturbing its tranquility? What sound came creeping to the good sister's ears?
Why, the unmistakable screech of Florian's fiddle as it mimicked the wind with its deep rushing sound.
Florian's off-state preferred dance of choice was the hornpipe. He liked jigs and reels, but by and large always plucked for the hornpipe. Yep, out of that, he'd say with a flourish of his bow, and show your uncle the cut of his heels.
As he sought out the melody of 4/4 time, shoving down copious swallows of the clear, throughout the dance you would notice his eyes, especially when approaching the close of the tune. I'm the twinkle toe kid, they seemed to say. And you'll dance it, damn you, you'll dance that hornpipe till your fucking heels bleed. The sisters loved to see him coming. They asked him to play the last rose of supper, the Thomas More song. And it must be admitted that he played it quite magnificently. It wasn't like the other tunes. It was softer, more lyrical, gentle, mellow, with the notes like drops of water falling slowly in the stillness, which was why they liked it so much, and why they probably thought that Florian's soul was probably something similar to its sad, drifting heart. They said he was the nicest man who had ever visited. They knew about the rumours, but they didn't believe a word. They loved his chat. He told them yarns about places he'd been. Stories about Cape Breton, and America, and Argentina. Places they had never been to before in their lives. How would they? They were only ordinary old country girls. Ordinary old country girls who had never left the slopes of Slieve. Never once in their quiet, exemplary lives. Uncle Florian was like something from their dreams. Secret dreams about which they never dared to tell anyone. Never a word about the nighttime visitors who would slip from the shadows with dark eyebrows and teeth and something they had which pleasured you and which most emphatically you could never speak of. That's what they thought when Florian arrived. Lifting up his bow to play the bold tambour. That was what they were thinking of when he'd stroke his chin and give them a wink, saying he liked hornpipes, especially with Little Red. They were afraid if they listened to Little Red's stories, especially the ones about being scared of the hornpipe, that Florian would disappear and never come back for as long as they lived. So they said to Little Red, "Button your lip, you moaning little ninny," and demanded that in future he look forward to Florian's visits. Those Sundays when Florian would say, "Right, sisters, me and me nephew is going off for a ramble. I have a few things to tell him about the goings on at home. A few little bits of private business, you understand?" Very good then, Florian's good sisters would say, "but make sure to come back and say goodbye before you go." "I will indeed, sisters, have no fear of that, my dears."
Throwing his arm around Little Red's shoulders as off they went down the slopes into the meadow, where Florian stamped out his stogie and grimaced, before grabbing a hold of them and muttering with a grunt, "Right so, Redmond, in with us here now behind the big tree. This is as good a place as any for you and me to dance our hornpipes. We can dance in here till our fucking heart's content. Get over there now till I get out me fiddle, till I get out me fiddle. Well, boys are there, ha ha." And such sawing and scraping as would fill the woods then, as the leaping music screeched above the tops of the tall pine trees. Little Red often thought of spilling the beans, of telling the nuns the actual truth about Florian's visits, of informing them just exactly what kind of hornpipes were going on behind that tall tree in the meadow. Hornpipes which included snapping likenesses with his camera.
"I like to snap likenesses with my own box brownie. The old box brownie I bought in America. Lift up your head now and say cheese for Uncle Flossie. Stick your lips out like you're giving Mammy a wee body."
Little Red had one of those phones. He'd kept one all his life, the only one which hadn't been vile. But he destroyed it in the end. Tore it in pieces one night he'd got drunk. I'll conclude, the final turns out the novel is narrated by Ned Strange as the devil. Nothing would give me greater pleasure to allow Redmond Hatch to conclude his own story. Regrettably, however, that is impossible. There are times, it has to be acknowledged, when he will make the most valiant efforts. I should say that Redmond is dead. He's taken his own life. So this is narrated from the grave. But he finds himself in a certain hotel bathroom standing mutely beside a torn shower curtain. And the remains of Redmond Hatch being ferried back to Slieve Magee Cemetery, his dying wishes laudably being respected before, with a minimum of ceremony, being conveniently delivered into whose uncommonly patient and tender loving arms, do you suppose? Why mine? The extended extremities of our Ned Strain, to whom they had been promised a long time ago, and who in turn had promised to shield his charge from the vagaries of wind and weather, outside a church one otherwise unremarkable day on Harold's Cross Road to the south of Dublin City. Redmond's eyes, when they opened, registered the most pleasant surprise, as he realized, to his delight, that he was not being confronted by some unspeakable, unimaginable horror, as might reasonably have been expected, but by a frosted light reflecting through the intersecting branches of the trees, and a radiant vision of the woman he had loved, attired in the most beautiful long dress of the whitest satin, with a glittering silver tiara on her head, parting her lace veil as she emerged from the pine. Approaching him, she softly murmured, "May you never lay your hair down without a hand to hold." Then lowered herself onto him ever so gently, whispering sweetly into his ear, calling him darling as she stroked his hair, before touching his neck with her tender, sugar lips. At which point the blood began to comprehensively drain from his face as he emitted his first sad, pitiable whimper, realizing just who his companion was, as I flashed my incisors and drew him towards me, Little Red. Slipping the chocolate bar into his hand, as we lay there together beneath the tall pine, from peep of the sun till the end of the day, before looking up to see them falling, the very first flakes of the most beautiful winter snow. Thank you very much.
To answer a few questions. I would also like to point out that there are books First I was looking at books out there, and then told, including the most recent one that hasn't been issued or released yet, and somehow it's already there. wait, those who have a question, please wait for the assistant with a microphone, okay? So please.
Yes, please.
Thank you for giving us this first reading ever of your book. My question is about films. Two of your other books made such successful films. I was wondering if there have been any proposals to film any of the others, The Dead Island and the Call Me the Breeze, for instance.
Well, it's so difficult to make a movie now. To actually set up a film, it takes maybe 7 years out of your life to get finance and to get a script together and everything else. And the real reason that I became involved in the film world at all was through my association with Neil Jordan, who had a long track record of many great movies, and because he showed interest in what I had to do, it was through his creative endeavors and his financial acumen and his standing basically in the film community that any of my books ever became movies. So it happens all the time, there's interest, but whether it ever comes to anything is another story. Because there is so much competition, and you know, you open the same week as King Kong as Bye Bye. So, but who knows, hopefully. But I mean, it was a very special relationship that we developed. It was symbiotic in many ways, and it was to be treasured. But it's kind of over now, because he's moved on.
Pat, as you know, you're in a city that's in mourning because of someone who was marginalized. When I read The Butcher's Boy about 10 years ago, what came across to me after I'd laughed a lot was that it was a great and very strong plea for people that are marginalized and people that are somehow fall through the cracks. Were you conscious of that when you were writing it?
To be perfectly honest, not really, because I think possibly, although I don't normally quote from reviews or critics either way, but there was one particular critic who came up with a sentence that really nailed what I was after. And it does sort of sound portentous, but I'm being honest because I'm so distant from the book now that it doesn't matter. And he said that what he found within the page of the book was an attempt to draw the mask of unbearable sadness through the ages. And I think, you know, whether it's what's happening in Iraq now or what happened in Montreal yesterday, that sometimes, whether the small hurts in childhood that leads to these things or leads to war, whatever it is, that there's kind of, they stay with you all your life. And that a lot of fiction really is an attempt to find an objective correlative for this deep hurt. And really that's what, without going into the details of that hurt, because everyone at some level of childhood understands that. It may seem small to others, but can attain an almost unbearable magnitude for one reason or another. And really that's what I was feeling rather than thinking, because I don't really think when I'm writing. But that does not necessarily mean that at some other level without knowing it, that I would have known people who became part of the narrative because they were marginalized, because the hurt found their home perfectly in that marginalized space. But I wasn't conscious of it, though. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can hear you.
I thought you read beautifully.
Thank you very much.
And I'm wondering if you have any experiences as an actor or a singer.
I think everybody of my generation before in Ireland had experience of acting. To be honest. I don't know if that's still the case, but it certainly was. I mean, I think it was Seamus Heaney that said, somebody said to him, well, how's it feel to be famous in Ireland? He said, well, everybody's famous in Ireland. Which well, it certainly was to him. I don't really have any experience, certainly not trained.
Hi. I was just wondering if you were conscious of any other Irish writing influences that you have, and who they might be, or what kind of relationship you have with the Irish tradition, specifically.
Well, I remember, I think it was Eudora Welty talking about William Faulkner, you know, she was a neighbour of his, really. She lived in, I think,
know, was in Memphis and he lived in Oxford. But she used to just look down the river track and see this great, which was because it's a great big mountain, and rather be afraid of it, she was reassured by it. I think Joyce is the same for our generation, and that every time you go to the USA, you find something else. Actually, every time you go to Portland, the artist, you find something else. My attraction to Joyce or my fascination with him is not the usual. It's that euphonic thing he has, the way he hears things. It's almost like near autistic or something. Is it that he just, he kind of, and I'm fascinated by that. I get very, very excited by that kind of place. So if there's any major influence that you just couldn't be without, it would be James Joyce. To be honest, although I might get kind of assassinated for saying this, but there are places with Beckett that I just kind of get, you know. I think it was John Gardner who said, you know, that so Mr. Beckett was home to his wife, and I said, yes, there's all the skulls there, yeah, see all the skeletons, that's it, another great day, you know, it's fantastic, isn't it? So that's it. And I always found it with James Joyce, you know, you're listening to Love's Old Sweet Song and the Tears Are Rolling. I mean, Joyce admitted sentiment. He allowed Melodrama in, you know. And so if you pare everything down, you take everything else, what are you left with? Just bare bone, and it just doesn't go for me. I prefer to go to the circus. Sorry about that, but I just can't pretend anymore. I'm sorry, I can't hide it anymore.
It's you all along.
Fight Club was interviewed on television this morning. He said that a writer has only 7 minutes to grab his reader. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I think if you say that, then you're buying into the whole cursed instant gratification blight that infected the world. I mean, that means then you've capitulated totally, that the media have dictated the pace of everything, you know, that they want it now and they're going to get it now, or else they're just going to throw the book in the bin. But I mean, this book certainly doesn't go that way. In fact, it demands and insists upon that the reader accept the pace at which it's delivered, that you cannot rush ahead with it. I mean, surely words are to be savored. I mean, there should be like caramels in your mouth. This whole thing of grabbing people, it's again another arm of the commodification of literature. And I think, no, there are as many different styles, as many different, and I wouldn't agree with that. It's possibly true in movies, all right, that you've got to get, it's a ludicrously competitive world, but as far as literature goes, no, I wouldn't possibly think in those terms. Maybe it's a screenwriter, yeah, that's true, but I couldn't. 7 minutes too short. Yeah, I can hear you. But actually, Joey Talon turned against him. Joey Talon wanted to go up on stage with him, and then when he was told that his application was being kept on file, and he realised that 1,000 other Joey Talons had been told this, well, he kind of took this kind of bad, and then started calling Bono names, did he not? As he'd say, how are you doing now, fuckface Bono? Actually, Bono enjoyed that, he told me. He did, yeah. So that's an unusual business. You just go around calling rock stars names and you get give you accolades. Yeah,
over there.
I'll try to be heard from you.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Having just read The Butcher Boy, we were talking in our class actually, the wonderful kind of tension between modernity and tradition.
Yeah.
Specifically one of the parts where Francie is encountered with the picture of the Virgin next to Kennedy, JFK, and just says, oh, you again. And
that's right.
I seem to kind of, at least in the first part you were just reading there of your new book, with this kind of sense of nostalgia at the carnival for people maybe losing a sense of tradition or feeling out of place. How do you feel having written The Butcher Boy so long ago,
uh-huh.
and now another book, but you know, within a country that's so changing all the time?
Well, hopefully within the pages of this book, which is clearly a very difficult book to read aloud, because there, it's a kind of a multi-layered fiction, and it's very, very hard to get the sense of it as simply in a reading. But it has been described by one of the Globe writers as a Gothic Irish metaphor for the conflict between modernity and antiquity. And that's precisely what it is, because it draws on the styles of Sheridan Le Fanu and Bram Stoker and various people in the Irish Gothic tradition, which I had never really consciously drawn from before, but for the purpose of this book, it was possible to ignore, because they deal with ghostly and the spectral and the unseen and the seen and the revenants and so on. And that's what I feel now about, because the pace of change has accelerated in Ireland so fast that you now could conceivably have the ghost of your grandfather in a retail business park or an unlet apartment and so on. So my conceit for writing about that, as in the death of the oral tradition and the breakup of community, which has happened in so many other places and following exactly the same pattern, but it's not a statement of that as such. So it's a kind of that's just another part of the process. I mean, it began, from my point of view, with the first television aerials going up in Francie Brady's world, and then it moved at a certain pace, but then accelerated to an almost ludicrous speed, as you find now, which equally, of course, is exciting, because these things, as a tide doesn't bring, it's not a blood-dimmed tide, it can bring many great things. First of all, the fact that people have dignity of dressing well and eat well and so on, these things are not solely the preserve of other places. We were supposed to go around chomping away on myths and stories like where the clothes were hanging off. But at the same time, it would take probably 5 or 6 books before I have any idea what I'm really trying to say about that. Yeah. If would. Yeah. If I'm trying to say anything.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being a very attentive audience.